22nd, the Senate Committee on Rules. We have a number of bills up, and I know we have a number of very important people to testify, so we're going to try and get you all on this morning in the next hour or so. We also have, for committee members, a number of bill introductions, and we may have a bill drafting request or two before the end of the committee hearing, so just to keep you posted. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 602, 603, 604, and ask Senator Morris to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Colleague. Welcome.
For the record, my name is Frank Morris, State Senator from District 8, representing Albany and Corvallis. First, I'd like to acknowledge the chief sponsor of these bills, Senator Ringel, for breaking ground and pushing the envelope. When I look at these bills, one of the analogies that comes to mind is the merger of two very strong companies. And in order for that to happen, when that merger likely is in the best interest of the shareholders of both companies, it takes visionary leadership and it takes selfless leadership in order for that to happen. And I think that may be an analogy that applies to these bills. Also, when I look at voter registration, and I would challenge you to think about that in this state, in the early 90s, voter registration, the independents, were in the single digits. And today, those registration numbers are in the 20s and even in some cases almost 30% of non-affiliated voters that have chosen to be independent rather than to be partisan with respect to Republicans or Democrats. And I guess the question that we maybe should ask ourselves is, why are people migrating to that non-affiliated status? And there are a lot of reasons. There's nothing that's simple about this, obviously. But I would suggest that maybe one reason is the definition of partisan. And I would share that with you. As a noun, partisan is any member of a body of detached light troops engaged in harassing an enemy.
Read that again.
Any member of a body of detached light troops engaged in harassing an enemy. Okay? It continues. A member of a guerrilla band within enemy lines engaged in demolition, incendiarism, diversionary attacks, and teaching sabotage. As an adjective, the definition is adherent to a party or faction, especially unreasoningly. I don't know whether that describes the legislature and our elected office, statewide offices, but I suspect that there may be a nexus between this definition and people's decisions to become non-affiliated in this state. And I would suggest that maybe there is a basis at this point in time to become visionary in this body and to think about how we can truly serve the public in a nonpartisan way. And I would encourage this this committee to consider these bills and give the Senate floor an opportunity to vote on them and refer them over to the other side and give them an opportunity to vote as well. I appreciate this opportunity, Madam Chair and colleagues, and thank you very much.
Thank you for your stimulating testimony. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I was particularly interested in the analogy of the merger of two strong companies. My only question is, after the merger, can we fire the CEO?
Well, That does happen.
Oh, from your lips to God's ears.
Thank you, Senator Morris. We appreciate you being here. For the rest of you that are here on 602, 603, 604, we'll get to you in, I hope, relatively short order. But we're going to close the public hearing on 602, 603, and 604, and we're open a public hearing on Senate Bill 160, and ask the committee administrator to give us a brief rundown of this particular bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 160 requires candidates and political committees to file electronic disclosure statements within 7 days of a campaign contribution or expenditure. It establishes a searchable internet database of disclosure statements available to the public free of charge.
Thank you. Colleagues, I plan to testify but on this bill, but rather than take your time at this point in time, I will be submitting written testimony. You should also have in front of you a letter from Governor Barbara Roberts, who cannot be here today, and Janice Thompson from MIPRAP, Money and Interest in Politics, should also be sending written testimony. And with that, I would ask Secretary of State Bill Bradbury to come forward, former Secretary of State Phil Kiesling to come forward, and is John Moon back? There's John. Come on up, John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We had a pre-meeting in the Senate Democratic Caucus Room, and I had to be guided there by Senator Ringo because you've moved your caucus room. Not recently, but I haven't been there in a while. So we did find it, however, I'm happy to report. So thank you.
You should come more often.
Okay, well, I'd love to. Chair Brown and members of the committee, for the record, Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State, and I really appreciate the opportunity to testify on what really is a historic bill in the legislative process. When it comes to campaign financing, rather than impose spending limits or provide public financing, Oregon relies solely on disclosure. The purpose is to give the public full information about where the money comes from and where it goes, and let the chips fall where they may. However, in the 2002-2003 election period, complaints to our office and subsequent investigation made it very clear that the current setup allowed a shell game of sorts, passing campaign money from one committee to another, making it extremely difficult to know what was really being spent by whom and for what purpose. So last year, I commissioned a bipartisan blue ribbon panel to study campaign finance disclosure law. The panel was charged to only look at disclosure and not other reform schemes such as spending limits or public financing. The panel consisted of four distinguished former Oregon Secretaries of State, Mark Hatfield, Barbara Roberts, Phil Kiesling, and Norman Paulus, and other outstanding representatives of groups concerned with the conduct of Oregon elections. And some of those folks are in the room today and will be providing testimony after I'm done. The panel's report called for the Secretary of State to introduce disclosure legislation, and I followed that direction. Senate Bill 160, which is what this hearing is about, encapsulates their recommendations. Among other measures, it calls for continuous web-based electronic filing of campaign finance reports. Basically, you fill out a TurboTax, TurboTax-like online form no later than 7 days after receiving a contribution or making an expenditure. This would make it easier to file, and it would eliminate simple clerical and deadline errors. It would also make it easier for all those small PACs that rarely have any activity, because if you don't have any activity, you don't report. It's just that simple. So the data from this website would also be available online in a highly searchable format so that the public could easily find information about a particular expenditure or contribution or all related contributions from their own home, their own office, or even the public library. They can get that information. The panel wanted to mitigate problems that come with so-called treasurer-to-treasurer transfers, so they recommended a new committee classification, and they call it the Candidate-Controlled Committee, to make it clear that money transfers that weren't really passing out of the candidate's reach would be reported. Because really, the treasurer-to-treasurer transfers are more like moving your wallet from one pocket to another. So the report really addresses that. Campaign loans were also identified by the panel as an area with too little disclosure. Consequently, Senate Bill 160 requires committees to disclose in a written agreement all terms of any loan received or made. At the same time, the panel recognized that it's easy for a campaign to get tripped up over nickels and dimes. So recommend eliminating itemizing expenditures of $100 or less. And finally, the information about contributors needs to be clarified. The panel recommended that committees should be required to obtain and report both the occupation of a contributor and the name and address of a contributor's employer. This will help Oregonians determine when individuals from a given sector or industry have contributed to a candidate. It seems appropriate to me that we're considering finance disclosure on the birthday of the president who could tell no lie. As recent events have shown us, it's important to let the whole truth be known about contributions and expenditures, and then the public can make its own informed decision. I just want to thank you again for your consideration of this bill and ask for your help in furthering the Oregon tradition of full campaign finance disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Phil Kiesling. I'm currently a vice president for Prodiax, an information technology consulting company based in Beaverton, and served on the panel along with three other colleagues who are former secretaries of state. I just want to commend the secretary and all the members of the panel for the hard work on this. It took dozens of hours, a lot of details. I spent in my staff 9 years at this. There is no absolutely perfect system. There is always just a goal to get to, and I think this set of recommendations moves the ball forward considerably. It is based, as Secretary Bradbury said, on the notion of transparency, moving Oregon really into the late 20th century with electronic filing, something that I worked on when I was Secretary of State, but it was always a challenge because you do need to invest money up front to get the systems together to allow people then to do this and to access it. But I think Oregonians have a fundamental right to information about where money comes from and where it is being spent in this aspect of the process. And these are recommendations that were arrived at and supported by all members of the task force. So I very much commend them to you and urge your support for the package.
Thank you. Mr. Lindback, and then we'll take questions.
I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. This is a totally different way. People need to think about this as a totally different way of disclosure, because obviously instead of those periodic reports that we know and love now, treasurers would provide the information on their contributions and their expenditures no later than 7 days after each one is made. For think about it, doing it every Friday if you were a treasurer, and you'd be just fine. And then that information is made available immediately to the public. The system does the math for you. It puts the If you put the required information on each transaction into the system, it will place it in all the right places. And it relieves the treasurer of doing, of worrying a lot about a lot of those rules that they have to worry about now. The system will take care of that for them as long as they input all the required information on each expenditure and on each contribution. It would also apply to be available to local candidates, not just statewide candidates, and it would be a much simpler process for campaigns to use in terms of providing the information needed, and will provide a searchable database for the first time for members of the public who are interested in researching campaign contributions and expenditures. And I'll hold it at that for now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. A couple of quick questions, and I don't know whether Mr. Lindbeck, Mr. Bradbury, you want to answer these, but could you talk a little bit about the practical practical implications for candidates? For example, I have CNE systems do my CNEs at this point in time, so I provide them with the information, they do it. How would this work under the system? And then could you talk a little bit about the costs involved for candidates, particularly those raising under $50,000?
Well, the vision is that it's such a simple process that a lot of candidates who are now paying someone to do this work for them could pay them to do that because it's a much simpler process. It would also open the opportunity for people who are paying folks and who have really huge campaigns to input their electronic filings that they're doing now directly into the system, and so life wouldn't change a whole lot for them, except that they would be reporting that information sooner rather than later, and more consistently over a long period of time rather than huge volumes of information if you're a large campaign shortly before those deadlines that we all have now. It has the potential here to save a lot of campaigns money, I believe, substantial sums, because it is a much simpler process.
Thank you. Questions from the panel? Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This sounds like an absolutely wonderful improvement to me, but I have a couple questions about how the thing will roll out. For instance, I have and have always used a certified public accountant, and the requirement for contributions and expenditures manual can be Byzantine in complexity. It's very difficult to get through it. It's not so much that it's a matter of doing the reporting, but the misery is in the coding. And very often we file these reports off periodically as they're required, and we just anticipate, it's like casting your bread upon the wire. We'll get a little nasty gram back from the Secretary of State's office, and there'll be the worksheets with the little symbols, cubes and triangles and arrows and handwritten documents and asterisks. And these direct us to go back over the coding, and then we'll monitor about, you know, geez, is it a this or is it a that? And obviously they think it's a that, we think it's a this, and some phone calls take place. Could this system be used to eliminate the necessity of coding? If you list the expenditure, isn't it possible that we could get to the place where listing the dollar amount, whether it's a contribution or an expenditure, and listing the purpose, then automatically is coded, so there's no argument about it with the Secretary of State's office?
Okay, Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, we'd certainly like to look at that. I can't guarantee that it would eliminate all coding, but the idea behind this is to make this a simpler process for the candidates and a more open and accessible process for the public. And we'd certainly like to make it as simple as possible in all aspects, including coding.
Problem, Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
I guess what I'm suggesting is not that you that the system that you're suggesting is a good one, but why have the candidates code? If there's an argument over it, you always win. Well, you just code them when you get the information and put it in there and make it automatic. And that way there's no argument about it. Just a suggestion, Madam Chairman. Another question?
Feel free.
Will this eliminate the requirement for periodic filing of CNE's reports?
The answer is yes. You would be continuously filing.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And the other question is, currently the CNE document is a sworn document. Will the electronic filing be a sworn document?
The answer to that is yes. Exactly how we do that, we've got to work with the people who help us develop the system to perfect that, but the answer is yes.
Perhaps, Madam Chairman, you can see the candidates standing reverentially beside their computer with their arm upheld as they enter the data. Madam Chairman, the final question.
They just teach the computer how to swear, that's all.
Actually, there is an answer to that question. Ms. Harris informs me that the federal court system uses electronic sworn documents, so we have precedence in other realms.
And finally, Madam Chairman,
Senator Farrelly.
Obviously, that brings into the question, you'd have to give your password to whoever it is that is your campaign chairperson or your CPA or your accountant, and your and obviously the candidate would have it. So there's maybe three or four people that would have access to your CNE. Can those, how will they be password protected? How will you verify who it is that's actually entering the data? And how will you provide security so hackers can't enter the system, change or rearrange the data, and post it online?
Very good question. Who would like to respond to that very good question?
I'll give it a try. We're going to look to online banking as our model in terms of providing security, and I'm not a technician. I don't know all of the ins and outs of security. The way we have always talked about this, and we've been talking about this in the Secretary of State's office for 4 years, a version of this, is that we would look for the same level of security that you have when you are banking online. We should not have to reinvent the wheel on this.
And,
Thank you.
Finished, but I have one more question.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Will the candidate or the committee still be required to maintain paper records?
Mm. Well, you would be able to print out, if you were going to use this system as your books, you would be able to print out anything on the system. You're still going to have checks. You're still going to be writing checks to people. You're still going to be receiving checks from people. So you're still going to be required to keep all that documentation in case any questions arise. It is possible, though, if you're a small campaign, to use this system as your books. Mm-hmm. And you can print out, use printouts from the system if you'd like. Most campaigns, however, as particularly statewide campaigns, are large enough that you're going to want, just like you have now, your set of books and then your campaign reporting system. They're separate functions.
Madam Chairman,
Senator Farrelly.
Currently, candidates and folks that maintain CNE records are required to keep those records in a place that they can be inspected by a member of the public at the public's request.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so, Madam Chairman, that means that we have a giant shoebox in our office where all the receipts go. Not true. They're actually meticulously cared for. And I'm wondering, though, this seems that the thrust here is disclosure, and I think that is exactly the right direction. But I don't believe this is going to relieve candidates or campaign committees of any responsibility, because they're going to have to maintain a concurrent paper record. They're going to have to maintain, you know, whatever system they have for receipts. That, as you mentioned, they'll have the check in and out and the deposit tickets and all the stuff that go to a documentation system. So I'm thinking that the real benefit here if we could take the thing as far as possible down the coding trail, because I think that's where most of the technical violations appear. I still think the candidacies are going to be required to maintain those paper records. So the real thrust of this, I think, is disclosure to the public and immediate access to disclosure. I think for that reason, Madam Chair, it's an excellent plan.
Great. I think your analysis is correct. Any other questions? Senator Shields.
I do want the record to show that for Senator Farioli, it's probably a giant shoebox. For me, it's never been more than a small Kleenex box.
Thank you, Senator Shields.
I'm interested. One other comment. When you were talking about the model of electronic banking with the banks, it scared me a little because I got an email last week that looked like it was from Washington Mutual, but in fact, it was some con, you know. So now I have this headache of thinking, gee, I'm going to be getting emails that may or may not be from the Secretary of State, you know. So this is going to have its problems. My question is relevant to the training of candidates. Are you going to have training and just invite them to come to Salem, or are you going to go out around the state? How are you going to do that?
Senator Shields, we have training now.
Right.
And we would continue to have training for candidates and treasurers and filing officers. The nature of that training would change, of course, in what we talk about, but we would include training on the new system as part of that.
Senator Shields.
So that means when they come for training, they're going to have to bring their computers, or, you know, I'm trying to make it, I mean, you can't train me. Well, you can't train me at all, but you couldn't train me if I didn't have my laptop or whatever with me. It sounds like training is going to get a lot more technical and a lot more complicated. And are you thinking that through? How are you going to do that?
Well, I think there'll be a new thing to train people about, but our goal and you know, we're going to try as hard as we can to make this system so simple that in terms of what you need to do to input your information about a contribution or what you need to do to input your information about an expenditure, that it's not going to take hours and hours of training. If it takes hours and hours of training to teach you how to do that, there's something wrong. So we want to build this system so that it's the training is also simple, as well as the procedures for inputting that information.
Madam Chair, might I just add a comment, which is we're talking about a web-based system. So that's where you need to know how to navigate a web-based system. It's not going to be your computer gets on the web.
Right.
So, I mean, once you're on the web, you just have to know how to navigate the system, not which keys to push on your computer.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that this is not a bill for Senator Courtney. Further questions, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. The bill refers to so many days after the contribution is received. Is there a definition somewhere? Is that defined, what it means to be received? I guess I'll ask specifically if it's sitting in my post office box right now, is that received?
I'll hope that Fred Neal corrects me if I'm wrong, but it's not received till you open the envelope and you have it in your hand, is my understanding.
How do we know that? Is that defined somewhere?
Is that right?
Received is defined. I'm going to yield my seat to the real expert here.
Thank you. And if I can ask a follow-up, what happens if the candidate actually receives the campaign contribution and then loses it, which I'm sure has happened before?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Fred Neal, Campaign Finance Director, Elections Division. Actually, with the post office box situation, we define by rule when a contribution is received so that when it is in the control of the committee, so either of the candidate or the agent of the candidate, your post office box is in your control if you're proximate to it. If you're in Salem and your post office box is in La Grande, you need to, and you're the only one with the key to the post office box, it's only when you go back to your home district and open your post office box are approximate to the post office. You can't manipulate the system so that you roll past a second pre-election reporting deadline by choosing not to go get the check that you know is there. So that's by rule, is when it's received. So when it's in your control, so that you know what it is, or you have the choice of knowing. We rarely have to go beyond that to examine specific transactions, the receipt of, and then pinning a date on.
Senator Ringo.
Well, just to follow up, my post office box is about 2 miles from my law office. We don't go there every day. I mean, it depends, if we're fundraising or not, but we may check it once a week. But you're making it sound like 2 miles might be considered proximate, and we would be in trouble if we'd,
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, that's exactly the situation that the seven-day accounting rule, seven-day entry rule accommodates, is that you are proximate, but you only go once a week. You have, then you should probably be going back to the campaign office and entering, opening all those pieces of mail and determining which are contributions and entering them into your ledger, and in this case, should this bill pass, into the web-based filing system. To Senator Brown's question about lost...
Or misplaced.
There is the ability to file amendments. Depends on when you find out that you've lost it, or find out that you were supposed to have gotten a check and it's been lost, to determine whether that goes into the report for the current accounting period, in which, say, you were informed today, or if you need to file amendments to a previous accounting period and a report that you've already filed. Still, you're simply, that would be an other disbursement. If you had reported a contribution and then it didn't get to the bank, your treasurer or accountant entered it at the computer at the campaign office, and then it didn't make it to the deposit, and you don't find that out until you get your bank statement back for that period, then that's an other disbursement. It's lost.
Thank you. Senator Ringo, are you done? Anybody else?
Madam Chairman.
Senator Ferrioli.
I think we're getting a feel here, but I do have a question about oftentimes campaign committees will receive a check or a contribution, and they decide for whatever reason to return it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my impression that they just stuff it back into an envelope and mail it back. But in light of the answer to your question, Senator Ringo's question, opening the envelope is a receipt of the contribution. And I guess in my opinion, it's negotiating the instrument that actually transfers the funds. So which is it? Is it I open the envelope and I have to report it, even if I'm going to send it back? Or once I make the deposit to the bank and negotiate the instrument, the funds are transferred at that point in time, they're in my control.
It's Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, Fred Neal again, it's both. If you choose to return it, you can do that within 7 days, and you don't report it at all. The fact that you opened it means it's received, but yes, indeed, you'd have to consciously deposit it in order to require it to be reported. What if you have deposited it, we recommend that you go ahead and record it and then do another disbursement for the return.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. We appreciate your time and your energy. Okay. Leave it to Senator Westland to mess up my committee schedule. With that, we're going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 160. I know we've got three folks scheduled to testify, Mr. Terrell, Ms. Miller, and Mr. Lundquist. If I can put you on hold for a few minutes, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 603 and ask Senator Westland, along with Mayor Jim Tory and Elaine Franklin, to come forward. If you don't mind testifying with these two folks.
Thank you.
Go ahead, James. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 603. I'm going to make my comments very short. The main reason that I support this measure or bill is my experience as an elected official, both as a city councilor and a mayor, in a nonpartisan situation, has led me to believe that you certainly don't have to check your value system in at the council chamber door to be an effective elected official, number one. And number two, I support this measure because what I found over the 11 years that I've been an elected official, I'm no longer one. And by the way, my name is Jim Torrey, and I live at 3593 River Point Drive, Eugene, Oregon. I apologize. I'm not used to this. I should by now, but I'm not. I believe that the process of policy development would be enhanced in this building if there was less impact placed on the initial at the end of the representative or senator's name and more impact based on the good quality ideas that exist in this building. And I believe that there's an opportunity to leverage the strength of all of the members of this body and to get behind specific pieces of legislation that are of value to the state of Oregon. I served on the League of Oregon Cities Board of Directors for a number of years. And as a part of that activity, I had an opportunity to work with other mayors from around the state of Oregon, and rarely, if ever, did I know the party that those people belonged to. And I believe we were very effective in being able to push before your body, as well as other places in Washington, D.C., improvements to the process in the state of Oregon. I'd like to see us continue to have that opportunity. Another area, probably my closest ally from the Association of Oregon Counties, is a judge from Condon, Oregon. And it wasn't until 3 months ago that I called her up and asked her, by the way, what party do you belong to? Frankly, I was kind of surprised when she told me. But that's beside the point. The fact is we work very effectively, both as elected city officials and elected county officials. And the last thing that I would speak to is the issue of the effectiveness of our two United States senators, Senator Wyden and Senator Smith, have been recognized in Washington, D.C. for their ability to work together, not on every issue, because we're not going to work together on every issue. But I think we can enhance the strength of this organization by the passage of this bill. And I would hope that you would find some way as a committee to pass this to the floor of the Senate and let the state of Oregon hear the debate as to why or why not something like this should take place. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Mayor Torrey, and thanks for being here. Senator Westlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here to testify in behalf of Senate Bill 603, as well as their companion bill 602 and 604, I think it's important to note that the most fundamental of our founding documents begin, "We the people," not "We the party." I think these bills, and in particular 603, this series of bills would have a profoundly positive impact on our ability to produce public policy in this building. I think it would have an impact at the polls, that it would increase turnout, that it would indeed enfranchise voters in this state. Currently, approximately 1 in 4 voters does not vote in our primary elections. That represents a significant body of thought, interest, and wishes of Oregon citizens that are not truly represented in our primary system. I think that's a shame. I think that should be changed. I think these bills are a courageous step, first step in the beginning of producing a more effective legislature, and a courageous step in producing a more involved, committed, and enfranchised electorate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Franklin.
Good morning. I'm Elaine Franklin, political consultant, Portland, Oregon. And I come to my support of SB 603 from two different perspectives. First, as a political consultant for Republican candidates, where I'm the first to admit I have run tough, aggressive partisan campaigns. And my second perspective comes from years of also working in the U.S. Senate, where to pass great pieces of legislation in that body, one had to learn that yesterday's enemy must become tomorrow's friend. Compromises had to be made and coalitions had to be formed. And I think that Oregon is suffering from twin demons. I think the first demon is excessively partisan races where each party vilifies the opponent with little regard for rules of engagement and, quite frankly, sometimes little regard for the truth. And the second is parties driving their candidates into corners on issues from which they cannot escape without fear of reprisal and sometimes from within their own party. These twin demons produce election outcomes that make it difficult to negotiate, to compromise, or to form coalitions to get anything done. So after more than 20 years in Republican politics, I've come to the conclusion that today's partisan campaigns and the actions of recent Oregon legislatures divided along party lines no longer serve Oregonians very well. The purpose of the party system, or one of the purposes at least, was to sift out and put up good candidates on the ballot. But sadly, I think Oregon's primary election process has been hijacked by fanatics, ideologues, and zealots. It started in the late 70s when moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats began to lose primary elections. Fanatics in both parties began to win their primaries. Winston Churchill, you know, once said, "A fanatic is one who can't change his mind and won't change the subject." So you ask an average Oregonian in one sentence to describe a Democrat, and you'll probably get one who wants to raise taxes to create more government spending, is pro-labor, anti-business, and supports gay marriage. Ask an average Oregonian in one sentence to describe a Republican, and you'll probably get one who opposes taxes, loves business, is anti-choice, and opposes gay marriage. Party labels and the rhetoric from the parties and the party fanatics over the last 20 years and their refusal to change the subject away from divisive issues to a discussion of solutions has caused stereotyping, but worse, has driven centrists and the majority of voters they represent, I think, to the sidelines. Potential candidates, moderate, smart, well-qualified to tackle the thorny issues of today, school budgets, civil unions, taxes, and the rural-urban divide, don't run for the Oregon legislature because most of them can't get through their party's primary. And party labels also produce expectations. Republicans, on the whole, are supposed to be anti-tax, pro-life. The party base expects nothing less of them. Just ask Republican Cheryl Walker. She voted as a representative against a parental notification measure, and she was defeated in her next primary. Just ask Republican Vic Backlund. Representative Backlund voted for the tax measure, and he was defeated in his next primary. Democrats, on the other hand, are supposed to be pro-choice, pro-union. The party base expects nothing less. So just ask how many pro-life Democrats there are in elected office. And just ask how difficult it is to get Democrats to support PERS reform. If the party line is not towed, reprisals are very common. Now, I do expect both Republicans and Democrat organizations to express opposition to dropping party labels because they don't want their primaries tainted and they think the other party has the advantage if party labels are dropped. But let's take a quick look at four examples. On the coast, for instance, House District 10. It's heavily Democrat. It's plus 10%, in fact, for Democrats. And Republican Alan Brown, when he runs as a partisan, wins by less than 2%. In fact, in 2004, he did win by less than 2%. But when Alan Brown runs as a non-partisan Republican, he wins by 20%. A centrist Democrat with good name recognition, well-known and respected in Eastern Oregon, could easily win a partisan election. Democrat Mike Thorne is a good example. Representative Bob Jensen has been elected as a registered Democrat and a registered Republican in a seat east of the mountain. Moderate Republican Chuck Burley won the 2004 Bend seat, but it was a very, very tight race. A centrist Democrat could easily win that race. And in Portland, a moderate Republican candidate could win a nonpartisan race for the legislature. There are now more independents in Multnomah County than there are Republicans. Republicans should not concede independence to the Democrats. In short, I doubt that either party would have the advantage if we drop party labels, but I am convinced that Oregonians would be the winners. In nonpartisan elections, would candidates have to work hard to get their own and not their party message out to voters? Yes. In nonpartisan elections, would voters have to find out where candidates stand on the voters' priority issues? Yes. In a nonpartisan legislature, would party political maneuvering with an eye to the next election be reduced? In my estimation, yes. Would talented centrist candidates who now fear the party zealots choose to run in nonpartisan elections? Yes. Would moderate legislatures make decisions based on the merits and not fear of reprisal in the next primary election? Yes. Would leadership and committee chairs be chosen by the whole rather than part of the whole? And might they be chosen because of talent and skill rather than because their party won the majority? Yes. And would a nonpartisan governor and a nonpartisan legislature be more inclined to exchange ideas and civil dialogue? In my estimation, yes. So in conclusion, let me say this. The partisan structure in Oregon, I think, has produced incivility, an uncertain future for funding of our schools, an underclass of moderates, and issues that go unaddressed in a legislative body that the public thinks is generally unproductive and irrelevant. Without party labels, we would still have political parties, but the parties would have far less power over individual campaigns and therefore less influence over decisions at the legislature. We would have decisions made on the best available information instead of the best available hit piece, and we would have complicated issues addressed by the best minds, regardless of party, and without fanatic, slavish devotion to party politics derived from party primaries. The original intent, in my estimation, of the two-party structure has been lost in Oregon. Good candidates will succeed without this outdated system. Thank you.
Thank you. A couple of questions. Other than Nebraska, any states with nonpartisan legislature or nonpartisan statewide elections?
Madam Chair, Ben Wenselin for the record. No, ma'am.
Thank you. And what about models? So then there's no other models for organization. How would you see the legislature organizing under a nonpartisan legislature?
Well, under nonpartisan legislature, it would be up to the body to adopt, if you will, I hesitate to use this word, but their own administrative rules as to how they conducted business. My preference would be that the presiding officer and committee chairs be elected by the body.
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Farioli?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This question is directed to the whole panel. It's in the order of a trivia question. What was the Margaret Thatcher's quote about people being willing to lay down their lives in the spirit of compromise? Does anybody remember that? I'll have to get on the Internet, Madam
Chairman. She's a countryman of mine, and I'm afraid I don't remember it.
The two-party systems came to us through a lot of challenge and toil and fire, and it stood the test of time. What will I say to the independents who are rising in the state of Oregon in their numbers when they wish to accede to full partyship in the case where you basically, instead of allowing them to organize and move forward in the two-party system, just pull the rug out from under them, homogenize this process, make a party affiliations a passé? What will we tell the independents about the denial of their political franchise under a system where we homogenize and allow people sort of to subsume their party affiliations and never disclose what affiliations they may have?
Mayor Tully?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senator Farioli, that's why I'm here supporting only Measure 603 at this point. I think it's an incremental first step to see if we can make this work within this body. It doesn't limit that capacity to have party affiliations for the statewide elected officials. Are definitely, at this point, we are certainly not ready to go forward, in my opinion, with doing this on a national level. I don't want to see us limit our ability in Washington, D.C. at this time. But I do think that this is a great first step. And I, in my campaigns for local offices, local city offices, I get the question of why can't the legislature be like a city council or a county commission and work together? One day you may be aligned with a person on an education funding bill in Eugene, and the next day you are totally opposed to that person's position because he or she can't see the value of an enterprise zone to generate economic development in your community. But issue by issue by issue, you finish with the issue and you go on to the next issue. And I think the people in Oregon would like to see that be able to happen. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Westland, did you wish to respond to that question as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Westland. Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I respectfully disagree with your assessment. As it currently stands, or you characterize independence as one identifiable group of individual party when there are indeed many facets of the independent percentage non-registered major party voters. I mean, you have everything from the Socialist to the Oregon Constitution Party, a very broad spectrum of differing political views. And currently, all of those individuals in non-major parties are not allowed to express their points of view and their philosophy in primary elections. That, I think, is a disenfranchisement of about 25%, one in four, of Oregon registered voters. So I would disagree with your assessment that they are not recognized or would not be recognized or their influence felt in elections. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Farrell, any further questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, a couple. So I guess what I'm hearing is that this would open the primaries to votes by anybody who would like to participate. So would primaries...
for the record, we have two witnesses nodding their heads, yes, Senator Westland and Ms. Elaine Franklin.
Would we still vote in districts, Madam Chair?
I see.
What was the question?
Well, do you vote in districts? Will we vote in districts?
Yes.
Assuming that wouldn't change. Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chairman, the comment that that Senator Westland made was intriguing. We the people, not we the party. I seem to vaguely remember Whigs and Tories and liberals and conservatives and Republicans and Democrats. The two-party system's been with us quite a long time. And I think that I understand this angst over the red-blue issue, and I think that's kind of where this whole thing is thrusting. But I'm not sure that sterilizing and homogenizing politics is going to take zealots out of the system. I don't think it's going to magically bring the folks that are moderates in the middle to the surface. I don't think it's going to resolve the issues. I don't think it's going to make compromise easier. Madam Chairman, in the two-party system that we have today, compromise happens a lot, and usually it's a compelling issue, and so compelling that people do, in fact, find that middle ground. We talked about Representative Jensen, who's been elected as a Democrat and a Republican. I seem to recall a brief moment when he was the chairman of the independent party in the state of Oregon, mm-hmm. with a minority of one. He was the caucus leader and the only member of his caucus. I've been nominated by both the Democratic and Republican voters of my district, and I see this as an exercise in asking Oregonians maybe to think about their system, but I don't see a compelling reason to walk away from 150 years of history and tradition, and even greater history and tradition in the two-party system that we've inherited. And we've got one state of the union that does this. We can't even be number one in this regard. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I take it that wasn't the question. Senator Ringo.
Well, I think if we're number two, we'll try harder.
I'd just like to make a couple comments, please. I mean, these bills weren't really introduced to the committee in a description of what they did, and I just wanted to state briefly that these are three different bills that have similar concepts. The first one, 602, would make legislative offices nonpartisan. 603 would add the statewide offices of governor, secretary of state, attorney general, treasurer. 604 would make all offices in Oregon elected on a nonpartisan basis, and that includes the congressional offices, the U.S. senator, as well as some county commission offices from other counties around the state. So, I mean, I've introduced these bills, and a lot of people are supporting different facets of them. To respond 2 minutes to Senate Ferrioli saying this, you know, the two-party system is serving us well. Well, we saw 3,500 people on the Capitol steps yesterday demanding a responsible approach to school funding. And I respectfully submit that our two-party system is not working very well. We have a dysfunctional tax system in our state, and I don't think the solution lies within this legislative body. We are not positioned. We do not have the capability to solve Oregon's most fundamental problems. I do not see that we can do that in a partisan system. You look and say, well, why would a nonpartisan system work any better? It's not going to be all happiness and everybody's going to get along fine, because you'd still have a lot of knockdown, drag-out disputes. You'd have power struggles. You'd still have business versus labor, urban versus rural. You'd have social conservatives versus social liberals. You have all those power divisions that go on in any political body. But here, we're automatically divided into two teams. You're either on this team or you're on that team. It sets up a lot of barriers to cooperation, and those barriers are harmful. And if you look at how a school board operates or a city council or how Nebraska operates, they have the power struggles, but they don't have the automatic divisions that are so harmful here. And I think I can give you a lot of examples, specific examples of what is damaging about the partisanship. But just a couple things. One is there's a lot of energy spent in this building, a lot of legislative maneuvering spent focused on the next election cycle. It's not designed to solve the problem. It's not designed to serve the citizens of Oregon. It's designed so that one party can use it against the other party during the next election cycle. That's harmful. Also, we exclude members of the minority party from leadership, and that's harmful. I think that you should be able to take the best Republicans and the best Democrats and promote them to leadership, rather than saying, well, one party happened to have a slight edge, therefore the other party is going to be completely excluded from leadership. That makes absolutely no sense. I went to Nebraska last March and spent a day there looking at the Nebraska legislature on how they operate. And it's fascinating. They have all the basic power struggles, but they never meet in party caucuses. They never meet in party caucuses. They have the urban rural, they have all those power struggles, but they don't have these automatic divides that with the parties that seem to separate us here and prevent us from moving forward. So all respect to Senator Ferrioli, is our two-party system serving as well? I don't think it's not. I don't think it is serving as well. I think the evidence is clear when you look at the scope of Oregon's problems. So I just wanted to put that on the record. And thank you three for coming and testifying.
Thank you, Senator Ringo. And I just, I'm not sure where I am on these three bills. I just would make a comment that I don't see nonpartisan legislature and nonpartisan statewide offices as solving all the problems. I am reminded of a comment by one of my former colleagues, Randy Leonard, who served in both the House and the Senate, And after serving a few years on city council, he remarked that he missed the camaraderie of the Oregon legislature. So I don't see this as a total and complete panacea. I'm certainly
no, Brown, I don't think anybody would sell it that way.
I'm certainly
let's not oversell it.
Very interested in the conversation. Senator Shields.
Thank you.
If I may interrupt, just Madam Chair, just consider the source of the tidbit of information with regard to this. Excuse me.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Elaine, I very much appreciated your testimony. I would like to request, if possible, that you make copies of that. It's very thoughtful. It shows a scope of both history and knowledge that a lot of us don't have, and if possible.
Thank you. And I do have some extra copies, and I will leave them with the appropriate person.
That'd be great.
Thank you. Follow up.
Sure, Senator Shields.
You've obviously given a lot of thought to the fact that the partisan system isn't working. How would you visualize the legislature? I realize there's three bills, but I'm thinking of the legislative one at this point, 603. How would you future visualize how this place would work? I mean, you have the vast experiences of one that's seen it at the federal level and watched races here at a local level and obviously been a consultant for a long time. How would you envision it working if, you know, 2 years or 5 years there were no parties? And the reason I'm saying this is because I have heard people say, well, we might not have a Republican or a Democrat caucus anymore. We'll just have liberal, conservative, and maybe moderate caucuses. You know, I get all kinds of dismissive language. I support Senate Bill 603. I'm very interested in it. But we need people to paint pictures for us of what it might look like. And I'm asking you to paint a possible picture of the future.
I'm not sure that I can look into a crystal ball and see that clearly into the future. I start from the premise that things appear not to be working right now, and maybe it will be incremental change, or maybe it will be a vast change all at once. I do know that the system appears not to be working right now. I've worked in the system for 20 years, and when I was in the U.S. Senate, camaraderie was appropriate and even attainable after some pretty nasty battles. That is changing in the Senate, too, because at the risk of offending some people, and I don't want to do that, ideologues grind their feet in cement, and ideologues tend to be on extremes of the party structure. I think I personally think that if you get more moderates from each party elected to the legislature and to statewide offices, you would have more of a cohesiveness that where better minds than mine, quite frankly, could produce a better outcome. I know the system is not working right now. I'm not for throwing the system out completely, but I am for certainly doing something fairly drastic to make this body, to make statewide issues come to the fore and be resolved in less partisan manners. So, Senator, I can't look into my crystal ball and give you all the answers. And nor am I actually quite frankly a person who says, "Oh, it's not working," so you throw the whole thing out, so you throw the baby out with the bathwater. But I do know that once you get a system of campaigning where the fringes are not pushing people through primaries, you get a much better system.
Thank you. Mayor Tory, you wish to respond, yeah, and then we need to move
Senator
on.
Senator Brown, Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, just for the record, I've been a Tory all my life. I have had an opportunity to negotiate with a Whig that I'm prepared to.
Thank you. We appreciate you very much being here, and Ms. Franklin, we're going to miss your wit at the Portland Roast Festival on Thursday. So, thank you. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 603 and 604 and open a work session on measures for introduction as committee measures. Okay. The chair would move introduction of the following measures. LC 1932, which proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution relating to measures authorizing property taxes to pay bonded indebtedness. 21 LC 2133, relating to tax credits for low-income housing. LC 2637, referred by the Transportation Committee, relating to residential construction contracts. LC 2687, referred by the Senate Transportation Committee, relating to vehicle dealers. LC 2688, referred by the Senate Transportation Committee relating to motor vehicles with weight of less than 10,000 pounds. LC 2689, referred by the Senate Transportation Committee relating to vehicle dealers. LC 2736, relating to workers' compensation. LC 2782, relating to physician assistant services for workers' compensation claims. LC 2797, referred by our Senate Transportation Committee. Joint memorial relating to preservation of federal funding for maintenance of navigation channels at current levels and expenditure of all monies collected in Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund. Is there any discussion on any of these measures? Would the clerk please call the roll? Where did Senator Ringo go?
Senator Ringo.
Senator Ringo, we need you at the dais.
Votes aye. <That's high. laughs>
Senator Atkinson?
He's excused.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Thank you.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye.
Senator Ringo's vote sounded more like a question than Chairman.
Well, I'm sure it won't be the first time, the last time either in this committee. Thank you for your cooperation. Then we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 603 and 604 and 602 and invite Phil Kiesing, Harvey Matthews, and Dr. Tom Beer to come forward. And then we got to go back to 160. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator, you know, after 5 years of being in the private sector, not once having testified before a legislative committee, I don't know whether to laugh or cry today. This is the second chance.
And who is the speaker, man?
We need you to identify yourself for the record,
Bill Kiesling at 3408 Southeast 8th in Portland, Oregon. I'd like to first introduce my a colleague of mine in this venture, Dr. Tom Baer, who'll go first and then we'll take it from there.
Chair Brown, my name is Tom Baer. I'm a physician and a resident in Southeast Portland, and this is the first time I've ever had a chance to testify before a legislative committee, so it's a real honor. And
you're doing great so far.
Fabulous experience. I'm going to keep my remarks very brief. I've been struck by two trends in Oregon politics and really in U.S. politics. One is the trend that's been articulated before, where party registration has moved from about 10% unaffiliated about a decade and a half ago to 25% or so now. What's not been said is that amongst voters between the ages of 18 and 35, the unaffiliated registration is the number one affiliate registration right now. So if you were to step back from politics and think about it as a business, if you're running a business and you lost your 18 to 35 demographic, I don't think you'd be running the business much longer. That's a huge shift that's very, very important. Another trend has been the increased polarization of the races. And I think while Oregon is not as far along in this as California, the 2004 experience of California is particularly striking, where 153 races for the California legislature and congressional delegation took place, and not a single one of those races did the office change hands from one party to another. So those two trends have conspired to really permanently disenfranchise a growing number of voters and the plurality of the voters under the age of 35. We're heading rapidly towards a system where not only is the plurality of the younger voters and a growing number of older voters disenfranchised from the primary elections, but as a result of the increasingly uncompetitive races, those voters' views are never represented. And in November, their voices don't matter. And essentially, we're electing our entire legislatures and governments in the primary elections where the largest voting bloc is not enfranchised. And so I think that every Oregon voter should have the right to vote in every election where candidates are selected for office. And only that kind of a reform will restore full legitimacy to our political process. And I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to step back. First of all, applaud Senator Ringo, his leadership, the very eloquent testimony you've heard earlier from proponents of this. And I think it's true that Democrats, Republicans, and Independents alike across the state like this idea and particularly like the inquiry around it. This needs to be front and center because, quite honestly, more and more of them believe that politics is broken and it's time to change the rules. Now, I want to talk specifically about Senate Bill 604, which is closest to an effort that I and others, Dr. Baer and others, are leading called the Oregon Voter Choice Primary. And I want to just make one distinction from the get-go very clear. The goal of making the legislature work a lot better is tremendously laudable. I really applaud it. It's very important. I served in the legislature, and I believe that it could work a lot better. The core premise, though, of the Oregon Voter Choice Primary goes far beyond any particular institution or any particular outcome. It is, at its very heart, the notion, as Dr. Baer said, every voter should be on an equal footing to have full participation in every election by which they choose those who govern them for every office. 604 is closer to that because its scope is truly every office. If you start from the premise that it's about Oregon voters, then every office ought to be available to them to make their choices. And that is exactly what that idea would do. Every voter gets the same ballot in May. Every voter, regardless of his or her political affiliation or the lack thereof, can vote for the candidate that he or she believes is the best for that particular office. You are no longer nominating anyone from a party label. Nominations are done over, finished. You are instead qualifying people, it's a key distinction, to then move to the November election where the top two stand and run in the finals. That notion of choice also affects candidates. Every candidate from the get-go can seek and appeal for the votes of every voter in his or her district or in the state and try to build coalitions from the get-go, coalitions that can help govern, not just be a matter of winning. Because the whole point of this is not winning. The whole point of why we have politics is how we govern ourselves. And I think, as people have pointed out, we have reached the point that winning a primary election is now tantamount to winning the election in more and more of these races. Let me do some math real quickly. If you have a congressional district race, take out 30% of the eligible voters who aren't even registered, take out the independents who can't participate, take out the registered party members who don't participate in that election either, you are literally, with two people in a primary contest, 12.5% of the total vote of all the people who are eligible in that district will win. If it's three or four candidates, the plurality may get down to less than 10%. So it is about choice and giving people that choice. But it is also about transparency. The current system clearly fails that test, too, because it pretends to be an election where the election is already over.
It forces candidates, I believe, to change their behavior to be politically viable, to run to a group of folks in that narrow bottleneck. Primaries, in a sense, have become the idea bottleneck of Oregon politics. But I think it's also important that people have an understanding of constructive partisanship, and at day's end, as we sort through these concepts, that we recognize that at the end of the day, there will always be some kind of partisanship. Now, my own thinking has evolved in this, because originally, a group that I was involved with wrote a bill that just simply says, make everything nonpartisan. And in fact, if you look at how the election law works, that is the easiest route to make this happen, is to label everything nonpartisan. But party registration is a matter of public record in the state of Oregon. And as long as it is a matter of public record, it is out there to be introduced by anybody, including the candidate. And we are not a two-party state. We are a multi-party state. Parties come and go. Minor parties have a role to play in Oregon as well. And, you know, in a world in which people are going to figure out where people stand on it, where people are going to need to want to find ways to figure out where candidates stand in very busy worlds, we would urge this committee, in working on Senate Bill 604 and passing that to the floor, the full scope bill, we would urge you to take a look at ways that, without compromising the notion of the goal here, a better, healthier discussion, that people would have a chance to know what party a given candidate is themselves registered with. Transparency, I believe, makes that, at the end of the day, a better choice, simplifies a number of very thorny questions, like the role of minor parties and how you fill vacancies and the like. But I also think trust voters to know that even with a party label out there, that at the end of the day, when you elect them under this system, they are far better equipped to govern in ways that are constructive to all of us. So with that, I would conclude too, and just saying that we would be the second state. Washington voters approved this 60-40. A century ago, in 1905, we brought the party primary out of the close-filled room with the party bosses. It was a great reform. I think we were second then too to Wisconsin. That was heralded at the time as a huge reform and vilified by people as being the destructive of all things good and proper in how politics circa 1905 worked. The premise of this effort that myself and others are involved with an initiative campaign, if the legislature is unable to muster the will to change these basic rules, is that this reform, just as a century ago the others, was a way to move Oregon forward. This reform is a way to do it for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Kiesling, your comments sort of raise a question in my mind, and I guess I saw the purpose of the primaries is to have the party pick a candidate. Why then have two elections? I think Sam Adams is very glad he had a second election, but I'm not sure Tom Potter is glad that he had a second election. There was certainly a lot of money that could have been used for other purposes. So why have a primary?
Senator, it's about the voters. It's not about individual candidates. It's not even about institutions. It's about the voters. How do you devise a set of rules to give the voters the best opportunities to choose those who govern them? We believe it is in a two-election process rather than a one-election process. Now, you could make that policy choice, and again, the group that I was with studied that and originally thought, yeah, maybe we should say if someone gets 50% plus one in round one, that's it. They are, in effect, elected. You have issues with federal law, first of all, with that. You have to actually elect people in November. That's one of the few strictures with federal law. But secondly, if you step back and think about it, a lot can happen between May and November, and the notion of having some remaining competition, we believe, is better. Washington State, and I would urge this committee to take a close look at what Washington voters approved 60-40 in November 2004, that's how they do it. Top two go to the finals.
Thank you. Senator Shields, and then we'll get to you, Mr. Matthews.
Yes. Bill, you made reference to the fact that you would identify, even though it's nonpartisan, the party affiliation of each candidate. Where are you talking about doing that?
informationally, there's two places to choose. One is in the voter's pamphlet. Could be made a required piece of information in the voter's pamphlet. I think it's in the bill right now. It's when you file it's listed, but I don't think the current version has the voter's pamphlet. Or you could just simply do it on the ballot. And it's an informational item. This person happens to be themselves a registered blank or lack thereof at the time, you know, they filed for office. It's informational.
Okay, now you've got me to the second question.
Mayor Shields.
That is, if it's on the ballot,
mm-hmm.
in a heavily Republican or a heavily Democrat district, wouldn't everybody put their name down as being a Republican or being a Democrat? You know what I'm saying?
They'd have to register. They'd have to make that choice. They'd have to go to the county courthouse and register in a new party. They can do that now.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're in a heavily Republican district where the election is decided in the May primary and truly decided, there's not a chance for a second round of it, you know, you could do that now, and I don't know if people do. I think that behavior, trust the voter.
Yeah.
Voters are pretty bright about this stuff. Gee, isn't this interesting? Phil Kiesling used to be a Democrat, now it suddenly shows up as this. Yeah, this is a difficult question. I've wrestled with it. I know Senator Ringo and I have talked a lot about it. We've wrestled with it. We've come to the conclusion that given the importance of transparency and the fact that it's out there anyway, don't hide it. Don't get into a situation where I am saying I'm nonpartisan, but I've been a registered Democrat for 20 years, and you can go to the internet and look that up. And my partisans, I love Frank Morse's definition, but let's remember what the best definition of partisanship is about. Partisanship based on ideas. Ideas vigorously argued, ideas fought out. Senator Farioli, I wish you were here, but he talked about what he likes about that system. We lack the courage in many cases to talk about ideas in a full, honest, and candid way, in part because we're afraid of getting ambushed in respect to political party primaries because of how that process works. Tax reform, health care reform, transportation funding, issues having to do with schools, you name it. We have let secondary and times even tertiary issues rise to the top in our public institution because there's safety in making those the most prominent issues, but we let the other things go too long unattended. Partisanship around ideas and what are constructive solutions that might transcend. You know, moderation is good in moderation. One person's extremism is another person's principles. I respect that. Now, we all will have places we land on issues, but there are, I would posit, issues before this body and before this country where a synthesis between traditional conservatives and liberals will produce not moderation, but progress. Not middle-of-the-roadedness, a little bit of that, a little bit of this, but brave, innovative solutions. Look at Oregon's tradition over the decades, whether it's the public ownership of the beaches, and land use planning, bottle bill. I put vote by mail on that list, although it's not as prominent as others. But when we have been able to transcend those divides, and I think that's the kind of partisanship in some ways we have way too little of, and we have the kind of partisanship that is tribal partisanship. Are you a D? Are you an R? That's all I need to know.
See, and Madam Chair, I guess I see that if you leave the party labels off, is what happens is that you are going to have the battle of ideas. You're going to have the battle based on ideas rather than the automatic organization of you show up here, all D's go in that room, all R's go in that room, and then the entire dynamic becomes the party struggle, not the struggle of ideas. And that's why, to me, it's so important to leave the party labels off.
Thank you, Senator Reed. Let's have Mr. Matthews testify, and then we need to move back to Senate Bill 160.
Thank you, Chairwoman Brown, members of the committee. I'm Harvey Matthews, representing Associated Oregon Industries. We're the state's largest business association with 23,000 members, and we're the state's oldest, over 100 years old. Prior to working for AOY, I was a member of the Speaker's office staff and enjoyed many fun-filled hours in the House Republican Caucus meeting experience, and I bring that to bear in this testimony as well. My position currently at AOI, besides being a lobbyist, is also the director of our Center for Citizen Leadership, which is both our political action committee and our outreach to people who are interested in becoming or learning more about the legislative process. Just last week, I had over 120 students from Senator Devlin's district come here to the Capitol, and they asked some very insightful questions about our legislative process. What is a caucus? When is the primary and who gets to vote? How does money from special interest groups, such as my own, affect elections? Want to answer those questions honestly and still instill in them a idea that getting involved is important in the legislative process is helpful to our state. And honestly, I had a hard time during some of those questions to accomplish both of those tasks. I'm here today because Oregon's business community strongly supports Senate Bill 604. We're grateful to stand beside the Oregon Progress Forum and to work with the leadership that Senator Ringo has provided on this issue. The business community cares for five distinct reasons, which I'll outline quickly here. The business community likes the idea of a competition of ideas on a level playing ground, and currently, as Phil Kiesling has described, the primary process is not a level playing ground when only 12% of a population can essentially make the decision for 100% of the constituents. That's a concern. The business community also believes that any process where there's a litmus test by either party for approval in order to get to the point of getting elected is a fundamental problem with the process. Thirdly, the business community thinks that by including Oregon's fastest growing political segment, independents, it moderates the legislative dialogue and forces this body to discuss critical issues that are not just critical to a few interest groups, but critical to the greater population of Oregon. Fourthly, I would say that the business community looks at this body and says, you know, I know my senator, I know my representative, they're good people, but the sum of the parts is greater than the whole. I'm not sure if I was quite clear on this. Other way around, perhaps.
Isn't.
Thank you. They know you are exceptional people. They understand your political beliefs, and they think you really are going to come to Salem to accomplish something. But when you come here, you get stuck in the meat grinder. This body, something about it, is dysfunctional. And so the business community very practically says, well, let's copy a system that does work. Let's look at elected bodies that do work, like city councils, like school boards, that operate under the same statute, and copy that, and hope that that does cause improvement. And lastly, the discussion amongst my board was heated, as perhaps we've brushed up against here. Some of them thought that we shouldn't be in the forefront and bring this to the legislature, but the majority thought that the legislature should be in front of initiatives, should have the opportunity to state their case to try and affect legislation. We believe strongly that it is a popular idea, that it will pass in initiative form, and we also believe that it would be good for this body to take the reins and to fashion it in a way that's usable instead of through the initiative process. So, with that, I want to say AOI strongly supports Senate Bill 604 and would like to have any questions now. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Matthews? Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here, particularly Dr. Baer, for your first time testifying. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 602, 603, 604, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 160 and invite Ms. Miller, Mr. Terrell, and Mr. Lundquist forward. And sorry to keep you guys waiting.
Terrell, you want to go ahead and start?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Norman Terrell, speaking on behalf...
Sorry.
It's all right. Many people mispronounce my name. It rhymes with Pearl, if that helps.
That's much easier.
I'm Norman Terrell, speaking on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm a League State Board member and member of the League's Action Committee, where I hold the campaign finance portfolio. The League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. I was also a member of the Secretary of State's Public Disclosure Panel, and I might add with some hesitation that I'm a computer analyst and software engineer and might be able to answer technical questions on this proposed computer system. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss SB 160 and express the League's strong support. The League has long supported campaign finance reform in Oregon. Our position on campaign finance states that methods of financing political campaigns should ensure the public's right to know, combat corruption and undue influence, enable candidates to compete more equitably for public office, and allow maximum citizen participation in the political process. SB 160 would vastly improve the public's ability to obtain timely and useful campaign finance information before elections. It would also vastly reduce the time and costs for candidates and political committees to comply with the public disclosure laws. Furthermore, county, city, and other local filing officers would be relieved of most responsibility and costs for public disclosure. This also provides the economies of scale that help justify a statewide electronic filing system. If anything, this proposal could go a bit further in repealing ORS 260-118 and requiring that petition proponents and opponent committees also file continuous electronic disclosure statements. Right now, there's a Big Bang disclosure report due with their petitions at the time they file it, and it catches up maybe a year or more of contributions and expenditures when they actually file the petition. So I believe it was the intent that the public disclosure panel, when we urged further study in this area, also John DiLorenzo was a member of the panel, and John DiLorenzo's alternative proposal in the final report of our panel opposed a 30-day before petition filing disclosure report, and I believe this also supports the same idea. In part, his proposal would have eliminated this need for an additional report if we had the electronic continuous disclosure for the petition filers as well. Finally, recent allegations by Democrats about Republicans' misuse of campaign contributions and recent Republican allegations about Democrats misreporting only strengthen the need for SB 160. These allegations have raised doubts in the public's mind about trusting legislators with campaign funds. In fact, the League believes that these allegations demonstrate the need for even stronger medicine in the form of campaign contribution limits that would be enabled by SJR 5 or SJR 3. Citizens and legislators alike are poorly served by when citizens mistrust their elected officials. It is in the interest of all of us to restore public trust and improve Oregon's political campaigns. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Turrell. Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Shields. My name is Andy Miller. I am the Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon. In the interest of time, I'm going to spare you listening to me read my testimony and just point out a few things that I want you to think about. First of all, as Mr. Turrell said, we were a very broad and diverse committee. We had the scope of the ideology. I was on it. John DiLorenzo was on it. Our experience was varied as well. We all agreed on one thing, and that was the searchable online reporting system database. We got a D, and if you've been listening to the radio or television, you've heard me say D minus. That was 2003. You have attached the report card, mm-hmm. And it explains how we got that. And also at the top of that attachment, there is a URL for a very good site that brings up the Campaign Disclosure Project in its entirety. I suggest that you have your LA get that for you. It's like a 65-page PDF, so I didn't want to print it out on my nonprofit budget. But the most interesting piece, I think, other than the introduction, which is the church lady piece, as I call it, the philosophy, is the 10 most important disclosure provisions of this model law. It was our intention to get as close as we could to the model law and take into account Oregon's unique nature. So we really want you to pass this bill. It's very important. It's the number one legislative priority of Common Cause Oregon. I'd like you to pass this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Lundquist.
Thank you, Senator Brown, and campaign and members of this committee. My role here is I'm serving on this committee.
And, for the record.
I'm Lundquist, Oregon Business Association. My role on this work group or this task force was not with the expertise that most of the members on the committee were. And the reason I was willing to serve on this is simply because I was to bring in sort of a grassroots legislator, business association impact to there. In other words, sort of a common sense, what the public sees as that. And that's all I tried to play on that role. I won't go over any of the other things that have already been said, but I do want to emphasize that the reason I went on was because it was about campaign disclosure. It was not about campaign finance reform. And those are two different issues, and I think the committee needs to be very cognizant of the fact that that's what we're all about. Simply today, all I want to speak about is potential amendment to this, and I have talked about this with the rest of the task force, and that is, I think, to complete the circle, if you will, the circle being here that we're trying to increase transparency. This is all about campaign disclosure. But I think it's difficult to complete that circle if you don't have the real nail in the coffin, so to speak, and that is where there are audits that give that final, acceptability by the community, by the taxpayers, by the voters. Now, I would not want that amendment to in any way detract from the bill itself, and if that becomes a distraction, then we ought to, I think, do that in a separate bill. And this is not about any recent things that have happened, but simply an audit, I think, brings that credibility to the process that the people expect. I think I'll just say this. What would the IRS be without any audits? I think that is part of the process, and so consequently, this is a potential amendment, but again, I don't want to get in the way. Thank you, Chair Brown.
Thank you. Just for the knowledge of the folks in the room, the chair plans to work this bill and move forward on it. We obviously need to get the amendments. I'm very interested in considering the audit amendment, so long as it's done consistently with the web-based system. So, but I'm very interested, and I'm hopeful, given the agreement reached by leadership in the House, that the House would be very receptive to this particular bill. Senator Shields, do you have a question? Another question? Okay. Any further comments from the panel? Thank all three of you very much for your very hard work. We really appreciate your time and energy.
Madam Chair, I'm sure we'd all be more than willing to help work with you on perfecting this bill.
Great. Thank you very much.
You.
Is there any further business to come before the committee? Does it look like it, since we've lost most of our warm bodies up here? With that, we're adjourned.
Thank you, Frank. Go right in.